WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello and welcome to WrestleSpective. I am Jason Mann, and joining me today is a first-time guest. He writes for Stereo Gum and is also a staffer at The Classical, where he regularly writes about professional wrestling. Tom Bryan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Excited to do it.
Yeah, glad to have you here. And today we are going to talk about the main event of ECW Guilty as Charged 1999. Shane Douglas defending the ECW Championship against the FTW World Champion Taz.
Former FTW World Champion.
Oh, he was
somehow the lead up to this match was super confusing and convoluted and didn't make a whole lot of sense.
Okay.
Because he had been like doing Shane Douglas's dirty work, Taz had.
Right.
And Shane Douglas had promised him money and Francine.
Ah.
And, but then during a match with Taz, with Sabu by first breaking his neck by suplexing him through a table and then dragging like Sabu's prone body on top of him, which somehow got Taz a shot at the world title. It didn't make, the ECW storytelling was always, it was always, you know, an excuse for ridiculousness, but this, I didn't see how any of it applied to anything else.
Sure. Well, this was a pretty big, this was a pretty big match in ECW's history as far as, they built it for quite a long time. Taz was, really got his start in ECW as far, that's the first place where he was known at all. Douglas at least had ECW or WCW and WWE stints even before he became big in ECW. But Taz is really a homegrown guy, a guy that had been built up and a guy whose character had kind of evolved from, because my understanding is the early days of ECW, he did sort of like basically like a Taz caveman thing and then kind of evolved into the almost like the what an Ultimate Fighter was thought of at the time, kind of the shooter with the suplexes and just really being stoic and tough and so on and so forth, but also running his mouth. He was he had kind of that mix of the trash talking but yet the emotionless facade oftentimes as well.
Yeah, he had a great cold stare. One of my favorite cold stares ever would be Taz with the towel, this like ratty towel over his head, standing across the ring from you and just like staring daggers at whoever he was about to wrestle.
Sure. Which worked very well, except for sometimes when Taz revealed his teeth. His teeth always weirded me out. I don't know what it was exactly. Like if it was just like, if he has, I don't know if it's like overbite or I don't know what it was, but I think maybe it's just because I'm used to Taz later, and it seems like his teeth were different at that point. I don't know if he had some work done or whatever, but I don't know. Whenever I see Taz during this period, I'm like, what's wrong with his teeth?
I never noticed his teeth.
I feel the same way about William Powell, the actor, sometimes. I don't know if you're a classic movie fan at all, but there are certain movies where William Powell's teeth look really weird.
No, I believe it.
Okay. Hopefully that is the first time that William Powell and Taz have ever been compared to each other. that is my hope, at least. So, so this was a big match and sort of a big involved, convoluted, complicated ECW storyline that they were kind of known for, at least. Just kind of like involving a lot of elements into one story, and it all kind of all sort of plays out here, but a lot of it plays out in such a kind of a rushed way that it's hard to really let it sink in, you know. It's just kind of it's interesting how that works out. Like, there are definitely a lot of elements to this match that I think are really compelling and really interesting, and I pretty much enjoyed it, but it's very, very there's a lot that really also doesn't work, but it's interesting to talk about, at least, that's for sure.
Well, it's, you know, the thing about ECW and the way their storytelling worked, especially the build-ups to these big matches like this, is like, it, you know, it's not like with, you know, WWE or TNA now, where they can build it up through weekly TV shows. I mean, they could. They had a weekly TV show, but their weekly TV show was on at like 4 a.m. in like random markets. Like, this was, I was in college in Syracuse at the time, and I remember like being drunk and staying up late one night and being like, "Oh wow, we've got it! It's on TV! It's right now!" And you know, staying up to watch it when I could, when like nothing else was going on. But nobody watched every episode of Hardcore TV.
Right.
Like, you know, I'm sure some people did, but it was like they couldn't build storylines in a, and they didn't try to build storylines in a linear way the way, you know, most wrestling companies would do, because nobody would see all of it. They just had to have a bunch of crazy stuff happen all at once, which is what they excelled at. I don't know if excel is the right word, but it's what they did
sure.
all the time.
Well, these fans certainly appreciated it.
Yeah. Should we talk about these fans?
We certainly should talk about these fans, yes.
Florida.
Yeah.
I rewatched the whole show, and you know, it had been a long time since I'd watched anything ECW related, and ECW fans have this like mythic reputation of being like so smart and funny and chanting funny stuff, and maybe they were really like that in the ECW arena or the Madhouse of Extreme or all these places, you know, where they'd be all the time. But they did this show in Florida, like outside Orlando, in what looked like a pretty big arena. Mm-hmm. Like, not like a WWE arena, but like bigger than you would think a third-year company could fill.
Like 3,000, 4,000 maybe?
Yeah, maybe more. Like,
okay.
It's hard to say.
Like minor league hockey arena type thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And the crowd just annoyed the hell out of me through the whole show. Like, it was like I found myself just like hating them. Like, there's... I know you don't like cussing on your podcast, which is going to be a difficult proposition for me.
We're okay. PG-13, you know, we can we'll get the gist of it anyway.
Well, yeah, like chanting a popular anti-gay slur at Danny Doring in the opening match just because his tights are pink and purple.
Yes.
Throughout. Like, not a joke or anything, just like that particular word at, you know, Danny Doring, and then show your boobs, I guess, at every like female valet through the whole night.
Yeah,
it was. I mean, it was just like embarrassing.
Yeah,
embarrassing in the way that like the John Cena Eve angle from a couple weeks ago was.
Sure. But, yeah, it's just sort of like honestly, like, I am not a huge ECW enthusiast. I wasn't particularly a big one at the time. I mean, I watched them occasionally, and some of the stuff I did was really awesome, but I really feel like that whole mythology of ECW, of these great crowds and you know, everything you were talking about, I think it really is mostly a myth. Like, I really – like, there's certainly, like, 10% of ECW, or maybe, you know, around that, you know – was really that exciting, great, full of life, full of all this great diversity in wrestling and exciting stuff and innovative stuff. Like, all that was there, but there was so much crap just around it that overwhelmed it with all these like repetitive brawls and you know, all these obnoxious fans that were that were just there to shout things and not really there to like appreciate the match or really like invest in what was going on in the ring, you know?
Right.
I feel like that's much more what ECW was than the good stuff. I'm not saying the good stuff wasn't there. I'm just saying I feel like it's way overwhelmed by the awfulness.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel kind of complicated about it because, I mean, this was the first ECW pay-per-view I ever saw. And outside of, like, you know, episodes of Hardcore TV when I was drunk at 4 a.m., like, the only ECW I'd ever seen. But, like, I my own personal background is that I wasn't a wrestling fan all through high school because I never had cable and I never knew where to start. And I just threw myself into it completely, like, freshman year of college, which is when this was, and got interested in, like, the internet and all the, you know, the stuff you do when you discover there's wrestling on the internet.
Sure.
And ECW appealed to me enormously. Like, it just seemed like, even before I'd ever, like, seen it, because, you know, I was like a punk in high school, and this was like the punk thing, like, oh, it's wrestling, but it's punk. And
right.
Everybody's mad all the time, and there's just constant violence. And so just the idea of this group of, like, braying fans who were just thirsty for blood, you know, you talk about the distinction between the good stuff and the terrible stuff, but I'm not sure that ECW saw the distinction. Like, I don't think Paul Heyman was like, oh, well, if I have, like, five, like, Balls of Mahoney, like, chair badge matches, then I can get Benoit and Malenko on the card and everybody will think it was cool. It was all, like, it was all in one kind of, like, mental jumble, it seemed like.
Okay. Yeah, I see what you're saying. I think that's pretty apt. Yeah. I don't know. I had kind of the same experience in high school. You know, I was kind of into, you know, alternative and punk and like, in on paper, ECW should have been a thing that I liked. I was the right age. I had the right sensibilities, right. I guess, you know.
Are you as old as I am?
I'm a couple years old. I'm 32. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
Right. So we're close, basically. So, but my point is that, yeah, I mean, I feel like I should have been in ECW. Like, everything about ECW is something that should have appealed to me at the age or at the time or whatever. But it never connected for me for whatever reason. You know, there were certain things.
There's a lot of reasons.
Yeah. There were certain things I appreciated and I still appreciate. But yeah, for the most part, like, I love WCW so much more, even though WCW had as many flaws and certainly had as much crap, but you know, in WWE when it was strong, you know, I really connected with those much more. I can't explain why to this day, but that's just kind of the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one thing that I think is really interesting here is that Shane Douglas, and I don't know if this is intentional or if this is just how I read it, or if this is just because he was burned out, but Shane Douglas looks really burnt out here. Like, he looks like the crown is weighing heavily on him, yeah. And he is just wants this burden to be done.
He was kind of a weird choice to be the man in ECW, you know?
Just throughout the entire history, or at this point?
At this point, I mean, throughout the history, it makes sense because he was the guy who, like, threw the NWA belt in the trash or whatever. But, like, the idea of ECW is this, like, anti-establishment place. Like, here you have this guy who's, you know, a lifer who's bounced around all the big companies, like, and never been a big deal. And that was one thing that was kind of cool about ECW is that, like, somebody who was a joke, like Aldo Montoya, could come in and just be a badass.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I always thought was interesting. But it was Shane Douglas. It was like, it's just this guy. Like, he just looks like another wrestler. He doesn't, like, you know, it's not like Sabu where he has, like, something that he does that makes him seem like he's insane. Like, he's just a, like, grunting, muscular dude.
Right. I mean, he was a loud mouth. He was certainly a lot of bluster. I mean, I guess it was the talking that really set him apart from a lot of other guys. But yeah, it was sort of like, I feel like this is very much like a transition. Like, Douglas was kind of like the guy they had because they didn't necessarily have another great choice at the time. Some of the talent had started leaving them, and in 98, 99, it would really accelerate more in 99. But it was kind of like he was the placeholder because he was the guy who had the credibility because he'd been champion before and could fill the role, and they were kind of comfortable with him there. And it was kind of – I mean, I assume the idea was to build up to Taz because Taz was champion for most of 99.
Right.
So it was just kind of have to have the strong guy to give to Taz, you know, eventually as they do that story. But yeah, I've never really been that impressed with Douglas overall. But I thought he was actually really good in moments here. Like, I really kind of thought he had, there was a lot of kind of layers that he was working with here that I thought were kind of cool.
Well, let me, all right. One thing that I kind of noticed watching him, like, throughout the show when he'd do promos beforehand and stuff like that, like, where was Triple H at this point in 99? Was he still, he was still DX, right?
Yes, he was just about to turn heel.
Okay, because it seems to me like there is a lot of the game character, like, in what Shane Douglas was doing at this moment. Like, obviously he's not as impressive a physical specimen as Triple H, but here you have this, like, muscle-bound, stubbly, like, blonde dude with, like, stringy hair that's wet all the time. Calls himself the franchise. Triple H calls himself the game.
Sure.
He's, like, the dominant champion who just runs everybody else down for, like, forever.
Right.
Even, like, Douglas seemed to, like, not defend his title that often.
Yeah.
And then, like, he's got this, like, it, Francine and Stephanie didn't even look entirely dissimilar.
Yeah.
As far as valets go. Like, it was, like, it never occurred to me at the time, but just watching this back, it was like, could some version of this have gone into the character that Triple H became?
That's interesting. I had never thought about that, but I do definitely see the parallels. And I think the other thing is that Douglas and Triple H both were portrayed and I think were both adept at the technical wrestling and the hardcore, you know, the brawling style wrestling. So, and that was kind of a separated thing because most of the champions in ECW were kind of good at one or the other. I mean, mostly they had the brawlers, I guess. At least the guys who were their champions. But yeah, Douglas could kind of do both. So that's interesting. I do agree, like, sort of in the way he articulates and the manner of speaking. I mean, Triple H couldn't swear like Douglas could, obviously, right. Just the restrictions that he had. But otherwise, yeah, even sort of the cadence of how Triple H talked. And I doubt that was I doubt that was an intentional thing. I mean, that was maybe just something randomly picked up either directly just by watching or maybe by watching other guys who are influenced or whatever, you know, kind of when something works in wrestling, it's copied a lot, intentionally or not. And I guess in music and, you know, almost anything really.
Everything, yep.
Yeah. So I really thought that, I kind of found that interesting. That, yeah, just Douglas, he just looks like he's still got that bluster. He still has that, like, you know, loud mouth thing, confidence thing, but it all seems so phony, you know, when he's in the promo he has before the match in particular. And I just wonder if that's, like, a decision that he made or whether Douglas, the person, was just so burned out from whatever, from injuries, from that schedule, you know, the dealing with everything, with, you know, having had, you know, he was 35 years old at this point, and had kind of flamed out in two companies. He would get another chance in WCW later that year, or maybe even in early 2000. I forget exactly when he debuted, but the point being, maybe he was at a point in his life, it's like, what am I doing? You know,
right.
You can read into it, whatever it was. I have no idea, but I find that very interesting.
Yeah, totally.
It's kind of an end of an era for him and for ECW, really. I mean, you know, Douglas was kind of, you know, the first 5 years was probably, you know, number one or number two guy. I mean, Raven was up there. Sandman was up there, too. But, I mean, he was there almost the entire time with this short WWE stint, you know, outside of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So my version of this, I do not have the Styles commentary. Like, Styles' commentary is overwhelmed by the crowd the entire time, but I don't think that was the case for most people.
Well, you could hear him. But, yeah, I mean, I think their whole technical side was so slapdash, at least compared to the major companies, that, like, they could have just been yelling over him, you know?
Okay.
Well, he could have picked up so much crowd noise in his mic or whatever. I mean, I don't know. I'm not too adept in all the technical stuff, but
sure.
I don't remember when I first watched the show live, like Styles being that overwhelmed.
Okay. I read some recaps that don't mention the audio problem because I barely heard him throughout the entire thing. I hear him a little bit during the introductions for Taz, and then I hear him again once the match is over, but I don't hear him at all during the match. So I think something's up with just the version that I watched. So, but I kind of found it interesting because I feel like in particular, the segments in the middle of the match when they go in the crowd are actually more effective because it's all like felt like I was there with the crowd more viscerally than I think I would have with the filter of Styles kind of blocking it. I mean, you would still hear the crowd noise, but it all mixes together.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, and I felt like I was there more, and I felt like more like kind of grabbed by it a little bit, other when otherwise it would have been a 5 minutes of them doing very little because they can't really do much going through the crowd. So
Yeah, see, I mean, I do you want to do like the whole like play by play, like run down everything that happens in the match?
sure.
Because it seems like a lot of that match was just in the crowd. Like maybe most of it. I wasn't timing it or anything.
Yeah, it feels like it would have been almost most of it because they probably start with 5 minutes in the ring. I mean, we start off with we have our in-ring intros. Interesting thing like that Francine sort of looks distracted and worried throughout this entire thing. Like she's not really sure he's going to be able to win it either, which kind of plays into my theory that maybe Douglas is kind of playing that up.
Also, as somebody who was, not that exposed to ECW before watching this show, I remember thinking like, there's no way Taz was going to lose this match.
Right.
Like, it might have been the first Taz match I'd ever seen, but just looking at the two of them, it was like, well, he's going to kill that other guy.
Right, which is obviously, what they were kind of building toward too, although it's a pretty even match, which is kind of interesting too. But anyway, so Douglas has a cast, which I think he'd been working with a broken arm for quite a while, which is why I don't think he'd been defending the title much,
That would make sense.
if I recall correctly. He also has a ponytail, which I have a thing against wrestlers with ponytails, but he takes it out quickly enough anyway. And
How do you feel about wrestlers with like Travis Bickle, Mohawks, and mutton chops?
I am much more in favor of that than ponytails.
Yeah, I thought Taz looked really cool.
Yeah. Anyway, Douglas badmouths Taz during the intros. Again, Taz is pretty stoic, but he does talk back a little bit, but definitely has the cold stare as you mentioned. I like
That's a big point to mention that like Taz went to the middle of the ring to stare at Douglas instead of just staying in his corner.
Okay.
Because I guess he always stayed in his corner. Taz had
Oh, right.
great theme music at the time too.
Yeah, although not quite as good as his WWE theme music, which I thought was
Oh,
one of
so
the.
much better than his WWE theme with the heart beeping or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh man. I think ECW, like one of its great underrated legacies is it did better with theme music than any other company ever.
I would agree with that for the most part, but I mean, I love the Taz WWE theme. So, but you're not as big of a fan of it.
All right, yeah, agree to disagree.
Okay, fair enough. I like the little touch with Francine refusing to let go of the gold, for a moment with referee tries to pull it, and of course lift it up during the introduction. So,
Yeah, she was a good concerned valet throughout. I liked the way she played her role.
yeah. Later on, and I didn't really notice this, but I read it in one of the recaps I read, like Francine actually, sort of when Douglas is getting the table, she's communicating with him where Taz is, so he's not surprised by Taz coming into the ring, which I thought was kind of a cool touch.
Okay, yeah, that's
Yeah,
good.
yeah. So I never really had much of an impression of Francine, but I agree she did some nice things here. So we have Taz does a double birds to middle fingers to Douglas, and then we kind of get a little tentative locking hands where they're kind of hesitant to do that. Then they get some mat work. Douglas gets a headlock, but then Taz counters with the leg scissors. Douglas pulls out of it, then Taz shoves him immediately down and gives him an FU, which Taz was not afraid to liberally use the F word during this during this match, which I guess was sort of an ECW thing.
No, I mean, if you watch the whole show, like the Dudley Boys segment, they go in on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like it gets like uncomfortable almost, and I'm a person who likes to cuss.
Yeah, I have no personal problem with swearing. It's just more like, yeah, when you, I talked about it on I reviewed another ECW show recently, and we noticed it as well. I mean, there was just so much of it. It's like almost like, I think when you first learn to swear, like you just, you just, you know, you overdo it. So this point, Douglas takes out the ponytail, which makes him look even more haggard, and I could not help but make the Randy the Ram comparison from the movie The Wrestler.
Yep.
It felt very much like he had that sort of thing.
That, like, weathered face.
Yes. Yeah. And he's also unshaven, and, I mean, he really is looking, like, you know, like pretty, you know, like I've harped on the whole, like, just so weary, just so tired, just so... But, I mean, he gives it a good fight, too. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he was obviously the veteran. He was obviously the guy, you know, and he's also like life is breaking down around him. Like his stable has broken apart, and so on and so forth. So he's, you know, losing his friends, which I guess all villains, you know, at the end of their arc, that's kind of what happened. The world breaks down around them. The hero finally gets his hands on them. And then, you know, then we have finally our moment of catharsis. So we have, a little bit more mat work. Douglas gets a wrist lock, Taz counters with an arm bar, and then Douglas gets a cradle for two. Taz gets a go behind and then rolls Douglas over for the pin, you know, which only gets two. And then Douglas is a little bit frustrated. But then Taz charges into Douglas's boot. Douglas gets a little cocky, so then Taz gets a T-bone, a suplex. Douglas bails, and then just is really in pretty, you know, sells the excruciating pain of the suplex on the outside. Then Francine's sort of there to give the encouragement.
Right. And Taz's suplexes, I mean, obviously they looked awesome because his whole character was built off of them, but they really did look awesome.
He did, like, yeah. Yeah.
He'd, like, just grab a bigger guy and just barely, like, alter his own, like, stance when he would just throw him like that and just really look like he'd be annihilating these guys. And also I thought it was interesting that they did all that mat work at the beginning that looked pretty good, and then they just didn't do it anymore. Like,
right.
The rest of the mat.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that sequence of the match. Like, I was really getting into that. Like, okay, this is a kind of a cool, you know, mat-based heavyweight-style match. I was, you know, kind of an old-school feel. And, yeah, then they basically abandoned it pretty quickly. I think Taz, like, interesting that and you talked about this a little bit with, you know, ECW's ability to create characters. But Taz and to hide guys' limitations and to build guys who really didn't make it elsewhere and to kind of find the thing that made them belong or made them a star and you know, and help do that. And I think Taz is sort of an example of a guy with obviously the limitations of his height, you know, and whatever, you know, not necessarily having like the body type that would, you know, be like a star looking body type and be able to, you know, accentuate his strength, his, you know, his brashness, his talking, but also having like the, you know, the cool look and, you know, the suplexes. I don't think in the ring, you know, he didn't really, wasn't necessarily great at selling. Maybe was limited in certain respects, but what he could do, he did well. And he, you know, he emphasized that. And that's really, something in pro wrestling that really, in, you know, is almost anything where, you know, you do what you're good at and you limit what you're not good at and then you can succeed.
Yeah. And there's such a long list of people who are like awesome in ECW or at least like, you know, effective in ECW and then totally floundered whenever they went anywhere else. You know, Taz is definitely one of those guys. Like he had his moments in WWE, but yeah, it, they just built his character really well.
Yeah, yeah. And it was mostly, I mean, he had a lot of squashes. I mean, that was kind of what they did to establish him. I mean, it wasn't just that, but I mean, he rolled through a bunch of people and dominated them and was just brash and tough and mean. I mean, that was kind of, you know, my understanding of kind of how they built him.
Which is really, that's how you should build a good wrestling character.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's more to it than that sometimes, but as far as like a guy who you're trying to get over as being with his physicality, it was kind of what they did with Taz, was being like, you know, the guy who can suplex anybody, the guy who has this really deadly, you know, finish, you know, this choke out that can take anybody down, which is kind of the cool thing about that move. It doesn't matter how big you are, he can get it on you. So, right. So then we get back in the ring. Douglas boots and chokes him out in the corner. Then we get a classy chant from the crowd, which I thought at first was choke her, would choke her bitch. And then it was actually, no, show your,
yeah,
right. So, which is interesting again, like, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Just wonderful people. Just an awesome group of guys in that right. crowd.
Which, you know, is like, it's interesting because, like, this is, like, the match they've been building toward for, like, a long time. It's just, yep. like, you would sort of be more interested in that than, you know, a vulgar chant against Francine at the moment, who isn't really doing anything, you know? So, then we get Taz gets a spine buster out of the corner, a clothesline, and then Douglas bails again, but this time he follows out. And then he punches him a few times, which I noticed that Douglas's staggering is very nice off of the punches. It almost reminded me of Terry Funk, who, wasn't, you know, at that level, because Terry Funk is one of the greatest things ever, but it was certainly, you know, kind of a cool little effect that he had there. And then we pretty much, Douglas reverses a whip into the rail and then jumps off the rail and hits a Fez press on the outside. The crowd just mobs around them. Like,
yeah, it's like the opposite of Scott Steiner and Rinka King.
Right. Exactly. Yes. Yes. It's just like they completely swarm them and it's like, ooh, kind of scary. Some security comes and kind of fends them off. And then they
not a lot.
No, they didn't have a lot of security, but eventually they're able to emerge from it. They brawl around for a bit, but they don't really do much because there's not room to do much.
Yeah, they're surrounded by. They're just like it's funny, you know, when they would have those like hardcore matches in WWE, like they'd be fighting in aisles, and the security guards would be there to like hold people back, and so you could actually see what was happening. But here, it's like. Like the cameraman's like cameras all shaking around. Cameraman's trying to keep up with them. Sure. You can't see them at all for like extended stretches because people are like shoving their faces in the camera and screaming. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, obviously there's no good wrestling happening here, or because there can't be. It's like it's not possible. But yeah. I kind of like the sort of like Cloverfield aspect of it.
Yeah.
Where it's just complete chaos and it just seems like just violence, like mob rule violence is happening.
Right. I thought that was good too. I thought like the sort of the obnoxious, you know, I wouldn't say obnoxious, but sort of the you know, just the crowd, the passion, the loudness, just the franticness and somewhat of the obnoxious actually worked for this because they're so frenzied, they're so crazy, they're so up in arms that it's sort of making the atmosphere seem greater than it is. But there is a lot of the one guy pulling the other guy, which I hate during brawls. Like I hate that so much. Like during the whole, when the hardcore stuff was really big, it was just so much of it. I'm just like, gosh, okay.
Especially when somebody bald would get dragged by his hair.
Right. Exactly.
Because somebody was just touching the top of his head.
Exactly. Well, you know, he really wants to go along with that guy. I don't know why, cause they're fighting, but okay. Yeah. So, and also Taz during the entire match, he says F the world a lot. Like that's sort of like, which I guess is his catchphrase, and he had the FTW belt. That was kind of his thing, but it was just sort of like, Taz is sort of the master of like chanting obvious things during his matches. That seems to be sort of like later on, like, well, I won't spoil it. We'll talk about it at the end, but there's something at the end that also fits into that as well. But yeah, I mean, other than the chaosness of the crowd, really, there is like a 5 to 7 to 8 minute part of this match where they're going around a bit. They do a couple of things, like Douglas lifts Taz up into the aisle and Taz punches him down, which merits an ECW chant, apparently, because that was an extreme punch. and then Taz sort of stands and raises hands to acknowledge him, then drops Shane's head onto the rail, which causes Shane to bleed. They fight some more and they sort of head back toward the ring. Then Douglas hits Taz with a chair. Then he sort of a nice thing where he stumbles down exhausted himself. And they briefly make their way down through the crowd even more. And it looks like they're going to head to the ring, but then Douglas stops and then grabs Taz to head back up around to another spot. And they end up, with Taz nailing a belly to belly, sort of lifting, Douglas over a rail and onto like a sort of an angled platform.
Yeah, I don't know why that platform was there.
I think it may have been like it may have normally been an opening that was covered for like maybe like where like a team might come out from a locker room entrance or something. Okay. That was kind of my guess, but I'm not really sure. Like it covered a lot, yeah. That I honestly don't know, but it was there and it was part of the arena setup. I don't think it was something they wasn't like a prop they had or something like that. And then so we you see nothing for a while. This is one of those moments where the camera has to kind of follow them. And eventually they emerge and they make their way through the crowd and they get to ringside. And so, yeah, basically, like I said, not really much going on during then worth talking about as far as the actual action goes.
Yeah, it was more the presentation of it was cool, especially as like a first time viewer. This seemed like just like nothing I'd seen before.
Right.
Like it actually looked like people in the crowd could conceivably get hurt as they mob these guys. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they actually, you know, in hindsight, like watching this for the second time, like after however many WWE hardcore brawls, it's pretty bad.
Sure. I do think it works slightly better for me today than it would have like in 2002, just because we're kind of so far removed from that hardcore thing that it's almost like a little bit novel again sometimes if you don't watch too much of it.
Mm-hmm.
I find like some of the brawls like that have aged. Now, you didn't really have the action in this for that to happen, but I do find like I will enjoy some of the hardcore stuff a little more because there's not so much of it today.
Yeah.
So like, so we're back at the ringside. Douglas lifts a table and pulls it into the ring. He sits it up in the corner as Taz is crawling into the ring. Douglas actually boots him in the head pretty viciously, repeatedly punches him, and Taz sort of challenges him to hit him at this point. And as Douglas is punching him, Taz is returning fire with punches to the belly. He stands up, he gets him a bunch, he puts him in the corner, he kicks him. Then he tries to whip Douglas, but then Douglas reverses the Irish whip and he goes right into the table. And I thought that was a nice way to cut off the comeback there. I thought that mm-hmm. was kind of an innovative way to do that.
Yeah.
And at this point, the ref even mentions like to Taz, hey, I'll stop this if you want me to. Then Douglas goes for the cover and we only get two, but Taz is bleeding again at this point.
Nobody really bleeds that much in this match, like given the type of match it is.
No, yeah, it's moderate blood. Douglas is kind of bleeding decently by the end, but yeah, it's not like a heavy blood thing. It's just sort of, it's a little more than incidental, but it's a little bit less than really having a whole lot of having much to do with the match other than just kind of being there for show, I guess.
Yeah, which is fine.
Sure.
Did its job nicely.
Yeah. So we have a really nasty looking neck snap from Douglas as Taz is, on the ground. He goes outside and looks under the ring, Douglas does. I find it funny that there are two ladders there that he could use, but instead he decides to go further under the table, under the ring, and grab another table.
He was really just digging under there for a while.
Right, yeah. So he really wanted that table, you know? I mean,
tables had ECW spray painted on their bottom.
But yeah.
Like the bottom of the table.
Right, that was kind of funny.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be broken anyway. So, well, I guess they needed it from before, so.
They weren't sure, like, the people at the arena knew that they weren't breaking the arena's tables. I don't know.
Maybe, yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if they spray-painted ECW on the arena's tables and they broke it. But given, you know, the shortcuts they were known for.
Mm-hmm.
So Douglas sets it up into the corner, but Taz ends up suplexing him into it, which only gets two. And at this point, now it just becomes a free-for-all. The lights go out. There's a lightning strike. We get a huge for ECW pyro entrance with Sabu.
Yeah, only pyro on the whole show.
Oh, really? Interesting. And then, as you mentioned, this is kind of playing off where Sabu was sort of supposed to be part of this, or he was chasing Douglas, but then Taz had taken him out. So we get Sabu kind of, you know, hating both guys, and then he leaps in, clotheslines them both, nails Taz with a chair, hits a baseball slide on Douglas, then does a moonsault off the chair onto the ropes that's supposed to sort of land on both, but only lands on Taz. Although for Sabu, as far as botches go, that was pretty minute, you know.
Did he really turn himself all the way around on the top rope, too, like while he was teetering there?
Right, yeah, because he hops. Yeah, I didn't really describe it well. He hops from the chair onto the rope, turns around on the rope, then does a moonsault from the rope.
It was it was kind of impressive.
It was very impressive, yeah.
But it was also, like, ridiculous, which I guess it's the thing with Sabu. Like, everything is simultaneously impressive and ridiculous. But I really liked this whole Sabu run-in. Like, I mean, I loved it at the time. But, like, because, like, I don't think it was common practice at the time when somebody would do a run-in or in a match that their music would play.
Right, the whole time,
get
too.
The whole entrance.
Right.
But he really did the whole entrance, and his music really played, and he had the only pyro on the show, and his music was really good.
Yeah.
And,
was awesome, yeah.
Just a cool moment that didn't have to happen, because it didn't really have any bearing in the match, because he just attacked both guys.
Yeah. And then he sort of just walks away at the end, like, oh, yeah. Okay, that's that. All right, I've proved my point, I guess.
He had no interest in what the eventual outcome was. He just wanted to just let both these guys know that he had, you know, Arabian Facebusters waiting for both of them.
Indeed. So, yeah, he dives onto the table through Douglas, which and Shane gives another look where it looks like he's just ready to be put through his misery after that table dive, which is kind of funny. Then Sabu tosses a chair at Taz. He puts him atop the table and does sort of a frog splash, but he, like, turns around and does it, you know, the opposite, you know, sort of rotates in the air and then is in the other position. So, and then we get Fonzie out there with the whistle. Now, I never got Fonzie. That's something I never really, like, I'm a big fan of, you know, the Fonz, but.
Right.
But Fonzie.
Where are you from, Jason?
I'm from Ohio.
Okay. Have you spent much time on the East Coast?
I mean, no, not really. Not a whole lot.
All right, because Fonzie, like, has the thickest Philly accent that I've ever experienced in any sort of, like, media way. Like, they don't let people with accents that thick on TV. And as a character, like, the whistle thing was so irritating, and I hated it. But I love that, like, just this total, like, Philly dirtball character was, like, such a big part of ECW with his, like, four teeth and his, like, gross haggard face and his constant screaming at the camera in this accent. And, like, I'm from Baltimore, so we hate Philadelphia at all times for all reasons. So him as this, you know, bad guy, because he was a bad guy for most of his run, I guess.
Sure.
It worked for me. I enjoyed it.
Okay. Well, that's a good perspective. I hadn't really considered any of that. So that's those are excellent points.
Interesting the extent to which ECW was a regional thing, even with its national pay-per-view and everything. Like, it seemed like it did most of its shows in the Northeast.
Right.
Or if it went south, it went to Florida, which is basically, like, you know, all Northeastern transplants anyway.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting how and you could see that in the early WWE days too, you know, in the 84, 85, you know, national expansion, how they still had those trappings of the territorial stuff. And WCW, of course, was, you know, rife with that for years. I mean, they, you know, they had all the Southern stereo stuff as well, you know, whether it was kind of how they presented their angles or some of their characters or, you know, into the music. They had a lot of, you know, country, for example, and some of their themes. So,
but even TNA now is like, has a Southern sensibility.
Sure, definitely. Yeah, it's kind of interesting how you just kind of never really, I mean, you know, you evolve through a certain point, but there's certain things that you just kind of know and you kind of are comfortable with, and that
it's,
and
obviously, like, that deep in the DNA.
Yeah, that reflects where you're from. Absolutely, yeah. So it's at this point, and that's that for the Sabu run-in. So Douglas crawls in. He only gets two on the count, although Douglas lifts his hand. I guess he thinks he's won. I'm a little confused by this. Francine is in, and you had the commentary, so maybe there was something, and maybe Styles explains what's going on better than I did without the commentary. But they both are sort of semi-celebrating, but not completely enthusiastically. The ref clears the ring of tables. Meanwhile, then Sonny comes in.
Oh, no. What he was doing is he was holding up the sign of the triple threat.
Oh, yes. That's right. Because
he needed help, is what he was like. He tried everything he could
right.
to beat Taz, and it wasn't working, so he needed help. So he tried.
Oh, okay.
Even though the triple threat was dead at this point,
right.
he was like, he needed help. So that was his, like, you know, Chris Candido bat signal.
Okay. So the triple threat, before they had broken up, That was Candido and Douglas, and it was Bigelow for a while, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I guess Benoit and Malenko were also in the triple threat at, like,
yeah.
Like, this is all, like, before I was watching, so I don't know for sure.
Okay. Yeah, I feel like there was, like, there were a couple versions of the triple threat. There was, like, the 94, 95, 96-ish version, and then there was, like, the late 97, 98 version. So I don't know exactly, but I do have Wikipedia available.
I think this was like a couple months after Bam Bam went to WCW and started feuding with Goldberg.
Right. Yes. This was just after he had, because that was November 98 when he went on a random Nitro and
with no music.
Right, it was during the Nash Goldberg feud. It was sort of a strange thing they added to it. Okay, originally it was Douglas, Benoit, Malenko at the same time, because Benoit and Malenko were tag champions. Douglas was the ECW champion. And then apparently there briefly Too Cold Scorpio was in it, but then that didn't last for very long. So that ended when Benoit and Malenko left. Probably the more famous one was Douglas, Candido, Brian Lee, and then Francine as the manager. And then Brian Lee was out, and then Bigelow was in, and that was pretty much. And then that lasted for a while. I guess Storm was in for a while, but then Storm got kicked out because he and Candido didn't get along. Then Bigelow came back, and then they did kind of the deal with Bigelow left, and they kind of did the deal with Taz being the enforcer, and that was it. So, and apparently there was a brief new triple threat with RVD, Sabu, and Taz in late 98. So,
okay.
So there we go. And then, according to Wikipedia, They then disbanded due to inner dissension. So,
fair enough.
There you go. So, that is my summary of Wikipedia's summary of the Triple Threat. So, anyway, back to the match. So, yeah, okay. So, right. So, he calls them in. Then we have Sonny and Chris Candido come in. Sonny and Francine get into a cat fight. Candido tries to pull her off. Then Francine attacks her again. And then Douglas tries to pull Francine off. Candido punches Douglas, which I guess officially ends their alliance. Taz gets a suplex right after that. Candido and Sonny both outside the ring. Candido tosses the towel to, of course, signify that, hey, you know, no longer. And I love this finish here. Douglas just has the perfect look in his eyes. He's bewildered at that he's been abandoned by all of his alliance, you know, allies, that he can't beat this guy, that he knows he's done for. Taz sort of comes from behind, almost like a monster, you know, slashes his throat, locks in the Taz mission. And I really love Douglas's struggle here. And yeah. That actually reminds me of like Triple H's struggle with when Benoit has him in the crossface at WrestleMania 20. Where like he's just, you know, Douglas is struggling to hard fight out of it, you know, won't completely go down. In fact, he even does briefly get out of it, but then Taz locks him in again. Taz screams, I guess he's screaming, "I'm choking you," which seems like the most matter of fact thing that Taz could possibly scream. And then Douglas, clearly fading, clearly about to passing out, gets one more FU into Taz before completely passing out, and the hand goes down three times, and that's it.
Yep.
So, nice little end there for Douglas being the number one guy. Kind of a nice moment they did there. I thought that was pretty cool. And, you know, and then Taz doesn't really get, like, a huge celebration. He lifts the belt up a little bit, but then he kind of walks out without it. You get a brief, like, wide shot of Francine checking Douglas in the ring, and then they move on to the Taz era is going to continue on to the next show and blah, blah, blah. So,
yeah, and it was, you know, I kind of like the not a big celebration from Taz thing.
Okay.
His character was just this, like, just miserable person who just liked beating people. And the fact that he wouldn't care that much about the glory of this belt that he just won.
Okay.
Like, it's just that he just, you know, ran through another guy and he feels good about that. And then that's it. And then he's going to be, you know, Sabu again in 2 months.
Yeah. Right. So yeah, I think it's an enjoyable, or it's an enjoyable experience to watch the match. I'm not sure it's a good match.
Right.
But there are definitely elements of it that I really enjoyed, and you know, it definitely gave. Like, I do feel like this does a pretty good job of giving you the flavor of what ECW was in early 1999.
Yeah, like the good and bad things about it.
Exactly, kind of what it evolved to. Because this was kind of like getting to the point where it started to kind of fade a bit creatively. I think. I mean, I think that was just. You know, they were losing a lot of talent and being replaced by guys who just, you know, weren't as good. I mean, they were trying hard, but they weren't quite as good, you know, and, you know, Heyman this was about 5 years into Heyman's run, and that's going to be tough for anybody and consistently trying to grow the company and, you know, having his strengths and weaknesses and doing that. It just, you know, I think it was probably burnout, probably just, you know, dealing with that competition, all those different things. This is kind of like, sort of maybe a bookend to the glory period of ECW, and then kind of getting into, you know, where it kind of the vision kind of was forced to sort of change, and it wasn't really necessarily as creatively satisfying, even though, you know, 99 through 2001 has some good stuff.
Well, I mean, this is the only period I really saw, except, right. You know, in retrospect. And I liked it throughout. I don't know how well all of it would hold up, but the whole show was a weird, interesting transitional show for ECW because it's where they brought in Sid.
Oh, yeah.
He made his ECW debut there and just utterly squashed, like brutally squashed John Cronus.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but it's also where they brought in Tajiri and Super Crazy.
Oh, yeah, they had their great match, yeah.
Yeah, had their first match against each other, which, like, blew my mind when I saw it. I'd, like, never seen anything like it as a, you know, a new wrestling fan.
Mm-hmm.
And that was before, like, Tajiri had his mustache and his goatee and everything, and they were just, like, just two guys. They didn't have a storyline or anything.
Yeah.
I don't even know if they were announced for the show beforehand. They were just there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was like, you know, the company, it never had one direction that it went in, but you see all these different directions that it's trying to go in at the same time, like on this show.
Sure, sure. Also, I think the, if I remember correctly, the Rob Van Dam Lance Storm match is pretty good, too.
Yeah. That's
yeah,
great.
Yeah, they have a pretty good one. So ECW is always an interesting. It's always interesting. You cannot say that ECW was boring. You could say, like, if you watch a whole show, there might be some repetitiveness that might get boring. But as far as, like, individual moments, you know, usually you watch 10 or 15 minutes of ECW here and there, you're rarely going to be bored.
Right.
Yeah. So, anything else you can think of to talk about as far as the match goes?
No, I think we covered it all.
Okay, cool. Well, so you became a fan. So you're the first promotion you really got into was ECW. You weren't WWE or WCW before that?
It was kind of all three of them at the same time.
Okay.
Like having cable for the first time. I think I wanted to start watching Nitro before anything else for some reason. I got really excited about watching Nitro and had to be convinced that I should be watching Raw instead.
Mm-hmm.
But that was like the first couple months of college and first time I had cable and it was all a little bit of a blur, but I started liking them all at about the same time.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool. Yeah. I was
like philosophically aligned with ECW, I guess.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Yeah. I was, the 90s were my second period of wrestling fandom. I was a big fan in the late 80s or early 90s, too. So I was kind of – I was one of the guys returning. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sure I have, but I usually most people that I talk to, most people that I know were fans as kids. It's interesting that you – I guess I get why, but interesting that you became a fan, relatively late for, you know, at least in my experience for most people.
Yeah, no, I mean, I was into it all in college and then kind of fell out of it out of college. And I really have only, like, I've come back to it in the last couple of years, but it's, you know, I'm by no means an expert or an authority or anything. I just like writing about it. And
sure.
Enough to let me do it.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you get writing about wrestling for the Classical?
Well, the Classical, you know, it was a Kickstarter project that a whole bunch of different sports writers, all like kind of smart conceptual sports writers mostly, mm-hmm. decided to all like throw their weight behind and see if they could raise enough money on Kickstarter, which they did. And I got approached to join that like initial group after I wrote I was in Chicago at the time and I wrote a Chicago Reader cover story on a Colt Cabana.
That's right. Yeah.
And then that had led to, and I also interviewed CM Punk for GQ. And like the day the Reader cover story was up, one of the Classical guys emailed me and asked me if I'd be interested in doing this. And they've been giving me like free reign to write about whatever I want, which is awesome.
That's great. Yeah, I've really enjoyed your work on the Classical. It's really nice. It's really nice to see places where there's great, writing about sports and other things and entertainment or whatever, actually covering wrestling and covering it seriously and actually, you know, writing about it in a smart way. I mean, that's definitely something, as a person who likes wrestling and thinks it's interesting and wants to hear about that and read about it that way, it's definitely something that's appreciated. So
thanks. Yeah, it's been a lot. I mean, it's nice that there's a climate that lets me do stuff like that. And writing about wrestling is like, I'm a music critic primarily, and it's what I've been doing for a living for like the last 7 or 8 years. And so getting to write about something that isn't music is awesome, and having it be wrestling is awesome. It's just fun to write about, like, the characters, like the actual, like I don't get starstruck around musicians, but I become like a weird quivering keep when I'm like in the actual physical proximity with wrestlers.
Uh-huh.
I can't have a conversation with them. It's weird.
Is there anyone in particular that you were particularly starstruck by, or?
Well, I mean, I went to Punk's house to do that interview.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so that was like, I psyched myself up for that pretty good. But then like 2 nights ago, I guess, or 3 nights ago, I went to a TNA house show here in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I live now.
Yeah.
And they treated me real nice and took me backstage and everything. But it was like, do I really want to like introduce myself to Bully Ray or whatever? Like, no. Like,
yeah.
I can't. Like visualize myself having a conversation with this dude, even though he's like standing right next to me.
Sure. Sure. What was Punk's house like? Is it nice or?
Oh, it's really nice. It's a condo and it's in Wicker Park in Chicago. Do you know Chicago at all?
Not really.
Well, Wicker Park is, you know, it's where I worked at the time, and it's a, you know, it's a the cool neighborhood.
Yeah. I've heard of it.
It's like kind of the yuppie neighborhood. And he has like, and all the buildings are kind of row houses, and his is above like a tattoo parlor and a coffee house.
Okay.
And it's just, there's just stuff everywhere. And as far as apartments go, I can't imagine too many wrestlers on his level would ever decide to live in an apartment.
Yeah.
But it's an awesome apartment with these giant windows and just like a big TV, and it was really cool. And he just had like comic books and stuff everywhere.
Yeah, well, obviously he's a guy who fans like us really enjoy, and of course most fans really enjoy. So it must have been a neat experience to interview him and write that and all that. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, he was real nice to me. Him and Colt both are have just been like totally. It's funny. I mean, he definitely has a reputation as being an asshole or whatever, but he was a totally lovely person the few times I've met him.
Well, that's cool. That's cool. All right. Well, anything else you want to mention to our listeners to check out? Of course, you're on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Tom Brian, Brehan. I write for Stereo Gum about music a lot every day. It's my primary job. So if you want to read me about music, that's where that is. I'm at theclassical.org, and I write about TV and sometimes wrestling for GQ.com too.
Cool.
And that's where my stuff is at.
All right, Tom. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Always appreciate everyone taking the time to listen and everyone's feedback. And until next time, thanks for listening.